Joining me on the Neil Wilkins podcast today is Craig Andrews, a US Marine turned electrical engineer and mobile phone designer, and now turned marketer and multi-best selling author. We had a bit of a pre-chat prior to pressing the record button for this particular episode, and we have discussed a number of very, very interesting topics, which I know you're going to get some huge value from. So welcome to the episode, Craig.
Neil, it's such a delight to be here. I've been looking forward to it.
Great stuff. And well, there's a backstory. There's a multiple career kind of journey that's been going on here. Apparently, you can't sell, but you're still very, very successful in business. There's a whole host of things going on here. Where to start?
Indeed. It's been an interesting life journey for certain.
So Take me back a little bit, because when we hear about, you know, Marines, we're hearing about sort of tech, we're hearing about writing, it's taken various kind of pathways. I mean, take us back quite a while before we kind of get into what's going on today, and kind of just give us a sense or a flavor of that journey, because it is quite, I guess I could use the word eclectic.
Yeah, it's, you know, so Saturday, I ran across a retired sailor, and we were chatting, and it turned out we had been stationed in Subic Bay in the Philippines at exactly the same time. Now, it's a massive base, so we didn't run into each other, and it's no longer a base these days. But at one point, he made a comment. He first assumed I was an officer, and then I told him I was enlisted, and he made a comment. He's like, "You don't seem like the typical guy that goes in the Marine Corps." I said, "Well, I was never accused of being a model student in high school. I had a horrible grade point average. And, you know, I just reached a point where I realized I needed to do something different. And it wasn't that I was struggling in school. The problem was I was not struggling at all. I was doing nothing. And so I was like, well, let's do something radically different. Let's join the Marine Corps." And I ran into my first great salesman, my recruiter. I went in wanting to sign up for 3. He got me signed up for 6. And it was 6 magnificent years. And the Marines I worked with were amazing people. It's an amazing culture. You know, part of that ties into, you know, I'm sure we'll get into this. You know, a little over 2 years ago, I'd spent 3 months in the hospital and I had to learn how to walk again. My body had completely atrophied. And I credit the mindset that I got in the Marines with the ability to push through the hard times during rehabilitation.
I must say, I've noticed in people I've worked with and in sort of personal life, anybody who comes from a military background, either, you know, a long listing or even short term kind of burst in that kind of field, they tend to have so many more life skills and so much more, I guess, in the toolkit, to kind of coin a phrase there. It just feels like you're kind of ready for anything that life throws at you. That must have been such an empowering thing kind of early, I guess, in your career and life.
You know, it was. And even in surprising ways, you know, this is going to sound bizarre. This is not what people would expect to learn in Marine boot camp. But one of my drill instructors taught me and everyone else how to iron a shirt. And the way he taught us how to iron a shirt, I use to this day. And the funny thing is, this guy was shaped like a walking wedge of cheese. You know, one of the most muscular people I've ever seen. And he's sitting there with his muscles bulging, holding an iron, saying, "All right, you know, scumbags, here's how you do it." And you know, there were so many life skills that were taught there, and it was so incredibly powerful. But, you know, when it comes to recovering, and, you know, when your body is withered away to nothing and you have no muscle mass, and you know, I was recovering from a really bad case of COVID. I had no lung capacity. And when you have to sit up and, you know, stand up and walk just so you could build a little bit more distance. And, you know, I'm not talking about walking a mile. I'm talking about, you know, walking, you know, 10 meters or, you know, in the US, you know, 100 feet or, well, that'd be 330 feet, but, you know, not very far at all. And the thing that the Marine Corps taught me was the ability to tap deeper into myself to find strength that I didn't realize that was there. And we all have it. It's just the Marines help you find it.
And then you kind of then moved from that kind of, I guess, immersive lifestyle into a more kind of series of commercial roles, because then you kind of almost like reinvented yourself. Did it feel like that when you came out?
It did. You know, so I went from being a horrible student in high school to, you know, by, if we use grade point average, at least as a metric, you know, an exceptional student. I graduated summa cum laude with a degree in electrical engineering and went on to get a master's degree. And, you know, it's what I knew. So in the Marine Corps, I actually repaired electronics. We did, I was with a squadron that did electronic warfare. When we flew over, your radars quit working. And so that got me exposed to electronics. I enjoyed it. I thought, well, I like to create. I like being creative. I want to build things. And so I thought, well, that's what engineers do. So I went to engineering school. Little did I know that that profession rewards creativity less than almost anything on the planet. You know, only accountants are less creative. I mean, I'm not bashing my, you know, former colleagues, great, great folks, but it wasn't the creative venture that I'd hoped for. And so that's what started moving me towards marketing. And I was performing well in my job. My first job out of university was designing mobile phones for one of the top three mobile phone makers in the world. And, if you remember back in the days when Ericsson made mobile phones, you know, I worked for Ericsson. I'd been to Basingstoke. We had a design center there in Basingstoke, not too far from you. Mm. Of course, the epicenter was up in Lund, Sweden, you know, near Malmö. For those that know where that is, for those that don't, think Copenhagen, very, very close to Copenhagen. And, I was doing well, being recognized for my work, but I just wasn't happy. And because I was missing that creative element. And so from there, I went off and I said, well, let me market semiconductors, chips for mobile phones. And I did that and enjoyed it immensely. And it was an opportunity to bring kind of the technical and the creative together and have a tremendous amount of fun. And when I was doing that, I visited all the top manufacturers. You know, most of them are, you know, no longer in the business, but, you know, I went back to Ericsson, you know, my former employer, then my customer, Nokia, you know, which, you know, people barely remember Nokia, but there was a time where one out of every two phones shipped in the world was made by Nokia. And Motorola, who's basically out of the business, they sold to a Chinese company, Lenovo. Visited Apple, they're still in the game, doing quite well. Visited Samsung, they've risen to number one. LG, who's now out of the game, but, you know, had the opportunity to go around and visit these top companies. And it was fun. You know, you'd run into your competition on the road, and it's a small field. You know, basically, if you're making chips for mobile phones, 95% of mobile phone production comes from the top five manufacturers. And for you to be viable as a chip company, you have to have three out of the five as customers. And so you'd obviously run into the competition. And the way you would meet with Samsung, getting into Samsung is like, you know, getting onto a military base. And you know, you get in, then you end up waiting a long time in the lobby, and inevitably the competition sitting there in the lobby. And we would, we would rib each other and, you know, say things like, hey guys, you can go home. We've got it from here. You know, don't want you to waste your time, you know, various ribbing, but it was very collegial. And, you know, we had mutual respect for each other, and it was a good life. But one of the things that happens, you know, people want phones cheaper. And when you make that volume of mobile phones, you have just incredible margin pressure. And something that I foresaw years in the making was eventually the day would come where they would ask me to fly coach to Asia. And I was going to Asia 4 or 5 times a year. I was like, no way am I going to do that for a living, you know, fly coach over there. Because it, depending upon where you were going, and these days you're going more and more into China, you know, going to somewhere like Taiwan from Austin, Texas, where I am, that was, yeah, it was about 18 to 20 hours total travel time. But as soon as you're going into China, you know, unless you're going into Shanghai or Beijing, you're now looking at 36 hours. And to do that in coach, like, nah, not quality of life. And so I knew, I'd already decided when that day came, I was going to leave that industry. And sure enough, that day came and I left that industry and started doing sort of general marketing for smaller companies.
It's great education, though, isn't it? I mean, I know my earlier career has, you know, almost sort of, you know, mirrored yours there in terms of the telecom side, because, you know, it was exciting times. It was, you felt that you were on this, you know, cusp of a wave that was going to literally, as it has, you know, take over the world. I mean, okay, the brand names have changed, but the essence of the industry is pretty much untouched even now. But the things that we kind of learned back in the day from, you know, our sort of peers, our colleagues, the competition. Yes, I can remember those collaborative, but also slightly contentious moments as you're sitting in the room, literally eyeballing them across the room. It was exciting times. It was really, yeah, it was kind of quite, quite an education, I think is probably the best way to put it. But we brought all of that kind of stuff, I guess, some of the best bits of that, because there were things that I would never want to repeat, and they wouldn't even be appropriate for the current kind of marketing or business environment that we're now living in terms of things like sustainability and, you know, all that kind of thing. But there were some things that really, really, they resonated then, and they're probably even more important now. And I think for me, one of the big things, and I was so fascinated by doing some research into your work, was just this whole thing about we shouldn't, and I'm paraphrasing here and you can correct me, Craig, but it's this whole thing about we really shouldn't be selling to sell. We should be enabling people to buy, actually helping them to buy. And that's me paraphrasing where I think your kind of career has kind of pointed and eventually ended up at this point today, is this whole idea about it's so much more than selling. We can do business without actually selling. It's about relationships. It's about really understanding the marketplace. Have I been reading this correctly?
No, absolutely. And, you know, one of the books I published recently is called Make Sales Magical. Is there anything more magical than having someone approach you and say, hey, I believe you can solve this problem for me. Can I pay you? You know, and that's just, for me, that is, you know, a wonderful moment, largely because I really suck at sales. I'm horrible at sales. You know, I'm a marketer and I love marketing, but selling is a different game and I'm not good at it. And so for me, it became a necessary pivot to, you know, to be able to survive as a business. But it's truly a magical moment when somebody comes to you and says, I believe you can solve this problem for me. May I pay you to do so? And, you know, for anybody that's been in business for themselves, you know, I think one of the most enchanting things is when you meet a stranger and that stranger all of a sudden realize, you know, for whatever reason, has the desire to pay you money because you add value to their life. For me, that's just completely enchanting.
And it feels kind of, somebody used the word wholesome to me. It's probably 3 or 4 years ago now, and it's really resonated. It just feels decent. It feels the right way to approach not only sales, I guess, but marketing more inherently as well. This whole idea that I'm going to give you lots of reasons to enter into a professional relationship with me. I'm not going to force stuff down your throat. I'm not going to tell you how life is going to be. I'm not going to sell you the features and benefits. I just want to talk and I just want to listen. And I want to enter into some kind of almost like negotiation with you. This feels like it's a much better way to, you know, both for big ticket sales, but I think also if you're working for an organization that maybe even does commodity products, positioning your offer in such a way of being receiving of the customer's needs, the customer's issues, pain points, and then actually meeting them at almost a partnership level, if that makes sense, rather than saying, hey, I've got these great things. It's better than the competition. I'll do you a good price deal. There you go. Do you want to buy? Just feels so inappropriate today, doesn't it?
It does. And I mean, if I project back 20 years, closer to 24 years, back when I was in the semiconductor world, what you're saying was at the core of a strategy that I launched that was incredibly successful back then, even then. And let me give this as an example, because it I think it makes a really powerful point. That's not about the product. It's not about the service. It's about the transformation that you're bringing to people's lives. And do you remember, you know, so obviously most people are familiar with a company called Hewlett Packard. And they spun off multiple divisions. But at the time, I believe they were still developing test and measurement equipment. They eventually spun that off to Agilent and then Keysight, I think is their current name. But one of the things I noticed, you know, as I was working on, I had a colleague that was building a new product. It was a revolutionary product. And I was responsible for the launch package. And as I was debating what to launch, I started looking at Hewlett-Packard. And I thought, you know, they don't make the best equipment, but they're always the first one to get the phone call when someone needs a piece of equipment. Always. I was like, how did they do that? And so I just sat down and spent some time studying what Hewlett-Packard did. And it hit me. And so I started putting together this launch package for this product. And it was based on three things. There were basically three legs to the whole strategy. One, the company I was working for had a history of sampling parts to customers before we had fully characterized them. And the customers would call us up and say, hey, your part's doing this weird thing. Do you know about it? And we'd say, let me get back to you. Tremendously embarrassing, but that was our reputation. And so for me to be successful, I had to change that perception. So the first pillar was we were going to take more test data on the part than we had any other part, more test data than we even thought we needed. And we were going to deliver it to the customer at the same time we sampled the part. The second stool, our second leg in the stool, was engineers have an insatiable desire to learn. And so we're going to put together a launch package that was going to make them smarter and better engineers. You know, it was about transforming their lives. And the third leg of the stool was we were going to put together tools that if they used our part, they could, that worked with our tools, they could go home at 5 p.m. If they used our competitor's part, they would have to work late. And so if you look at that, and it was an enormously powerful strategy. We ended up hiring some of the sales team from our competitor, our top competitor, and they said, yeah, we haven't been able to sell anything for 2 years. But if you notice what's missing from that is the features. Now, the product obviously had features, but the core strategy was let's deliver something to them that, you know, if our customers, engineers and engineers crave competency and knowledge, let's make sure we make them more competent and more knowledgeable so they can do their job better. They often feel overworked and stressed. So let's give them the tools so if they choose us, they get to go home and spend time with their family. and then let's deal with this, you know, this nasty little reputation that we have in the industry, you know, and just beat it with a 50-pound sledgehammer, you know, to change the perception. So they feel comfortable. And that was about removing fear.
I'm curious about this whole thing about delivering a product that isn't actually complete, because there's something quite neat about that, isn't there? That if you're confident enough and bullish enough, and if you've got the right kind of relationship in terms of actually getting customer feedback before maybe you do the full launch, so this could be kind of either in a beta stage or a soft launch, if you're willing to kind of go there, the feedback that you're going to get, the kind of the honest truth about whether this product is going to fly in the longer term, you're going to get that feedback from the customer, aren't you? So there's, even at that stage, there's this really kind of really smart way of doing business, which is all about, well, I guess you could use the word trust here. If we trust you with this product, we know it's not fully featured yet. It's not even a minimum viable product. It's not an MVP. It's just kind of like, it's pretty raw. But because we trust you and you trust us, please give this thing a go. See if you can get some value from it, but give us the feedback. This is proper relationship building, isn't it? If you can actually have the confidence to do it. But most organizations, most brands wouldn't go there, would they? Because it's just, oh no, it has to be absolutely 100% perfect, because otherwise, et cetera, et cetera. But if you did, wow, that would help selling, wouldn't it?
It would. And but you have to be very, very careful in communicating. The problem we were running into was there was anomalous behavior in the product that we hadn't told them was there, because we didn't know it was there. And so that's the, you know, I used to have a saying that nobody likes surprises unless it's a puppy. And I since struck that, you know, from the vernacular. I don't know if you remember years ago, Apple, when they launched, I think it was, they were launching something, and when you bought the product, you automatically had a free copy of a U2 album downloaded on your iPod. And that caused a revolt, because people were like, wait a minute, you're taking away my autonomy. And so they revolted. So yes, to your point, having those relationships where you're having deeper discussions are absolutely critical. And, you know, and when you can deliver something in not fully polished format, and I would qualify and be very clear where it is and is not polished, so that they can go in and start getting some early use out of it and give some early feedback, is tremendously valuable. But, you know, if you surprise them, if you give them the idea that, hey, everything is working, or at least these features are working, and they discover in their testing that some of the features you said are working are not working, that's where we were running into problems.
So it's about doing it really consciously, isn't it? It's not about saying it fits for every customer or every situation or every product. It's about at the right place at the right time with the right organization, it might just be a way that you can do it. So again, this is all about just really kind of mindful marketing, isn't it? It's not saying, hey, we got one kind of, you know, form of doing business and we do it like this every time. It's about kind of, I guess, sensing, testing the water, you know, really understanding and properly, again, listening to the market, which is, again, you know, something you and I have grown up with, is you cannot do business without really understanding the dynamics of the market. Does that for you continue in this emerging world of AI and all the kind of various emerging technologies and opportunities? Is that kind of market sensing, if we were to call it that, is that still really important, do you think?
Well, I think always, you know, there's some basic traits of human beings that never change. You know, technology changes, but humans remain the same. And, you know, now the way humans use the technology and benefit from the technology changes. And, you know, and certainly there is, there's time where you grow warmer to some technological change. And, you know, you go from, you know, there used to be a day that, you know, you couldn't ship software without having a, you know, a 2-inch thick manual on how to use that software. Well, I haven't seen a software manual in ages. you know, for my things for like Microsoft Word used to come with this big book teaching you how to use it. So that's a place where it's changed. But kind of coming back to your comment about AI, you know, something I posted about recently. I remember, you know, I grew up in the early days of personal computers. I had an Apple II computer in the house. You know, it was one of the first of my peers. While I was doing horribly in school, I was actually teaching myself how to code on an Apple II. And I remember when they were launching the personal computer and they were trying different marketing things, and they talked about all the things that the personal computer would do. And one of the promises was, this is where you will store your recipes. So you no longer need recipe cards in the kitchen. You will store the recipes on your computer. And I always struggled with that because, especially back in those days, even today, it takes 30 seconds to a couple minutes to boot up a computer. And back in the days with the ginormous monitors, I was trying to picture, where do you put the computer in the kitchen? And when you need the computer for things other than cooking, how do you use it in the kitchen? And I was looking at it and then just like, it's like that never made sense. And so here we are decades after the advent of the personal computer and the promise that, you know, that would be where you would store your recipe cards. And most people I know still keep little index cards for their recipes. And so sometimes we try to shoehorn a technology in areas it doesn't belong. And I see some of that going on with AI. I see people seeing AI as this sort of holy thing, you know, holy grail. You turn it loose and it, you know, it will wake you up in the morning, brush your teeth, press your clothing, and get you ready for your day. And it's not. I mean, it has, well, and those sort of things actually are probably, you know, presuming it was that far advanced, are not so bad. Where I see people using AI that concerns me is they're using it, they're hoping to replace customer service with AI. As a matter of fact, I think Google has just taken a move recently to replace a bunch of their salespeople around Google Ads with AI, with the little chatbots. And I think they will live to regret that. You know, their saving grace is they run a near monopoly on search ads, but you know, there's no such thing as an enduring monopoly. And you know, so I think the human factor is really key. You know, and we talked earlier about how, you know, so I had one book that we spoke about, Make Sales Magical. About the same time, I published another book with my wife called Hope That Won't Die, which was about my journey through the hospital with COVID. And, you know, I had some people ask me, they're like, hey, did you have AI help you write those books? I said, no, and I don't think AI could. You know, when you look at some of the structures in there, some of those structures are places where you still need human creativity. You still need human, you know, AI can copy what's out there, but when you're trying to do something, you know, a little bit different, it's, you know, it's harder. And the, you know, and so if I look at some of the sentence structures or paragraph structures that, you know, that I had in that book, let me take, for instance, Hope That Won't Die. Here's you know, a short paragraph from context is, it was 6 hours before they called my wife in the middle of the night asking for permission to put me on the ventilator and telling her I was going to die. And so the paragraph reads, the doctor stopped by for a brief chastisement. Not Droopy the doctor, different character in the book, not Droopy the doctor. This doctor was more like a schoolmarm with an exceptionally high opinion of himself. And his schoolmarm duties today were to inform me of my sins and to tell me how bad things come to those who sin. As I've reflected on that conversation, I've realized that he thought I would die in the next few days. So his priority was to make his last words to a dying man a chastisement. How does AI write that? What's the prompt you use to get AI to write those words?
Well, that's yeah. I mean, if we ever get to the point where that is possible, then we've gone way beyond, I think, anything that's been conceived of to this point, haven't we? Because that is so human. It's beyond human. I mean, it's, yeah. There's no form of machine learning that I'm aware of yet, or even that's being planned for there yet, that would be able to even kind of go there.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm sure you've seen the same thing I've seen. People are spinning up thousands of blog articles that are AI generated. And so that's the new competition. That's sort of the, let's say that that's the noise floor. You know, the noise floor that that's out there is endless content that's AI generated. So if you're going to AI to write your blog posts, to write your emails, to write your content, to write your book, you're going to be at the noise level. You will never rise above the noise level. The only way to rise above the noise level is in writing, to write things like I just recited to you. And of course, that's a personal story with deep personal connections. But in the book, Make Sales Magical, I have other things that I think are completely impossible for AI to write. I would spend more time writing the prompts than I would just actually writing it. And so I think the challenge in this era of AI, it's powerful. I use AI every single day, multiple times a day. It's become an important part of my life. But there are parts of my life it will never, I don't see it replacing. And as a matter of fact, I see it as a strategic advantage that if you can write well, you will rise above the noise floor. You will rise above those thousands and, you know, millions of articles being written by AI. And if you can't write well, my encouragement would be today's a good day to start. You know, it's, you know, you're not, the whole notion, some of the best advice I got from somebody who taught me a lot about writing, he said, you know, at the end of the day, we're really word monkeys. This whole idea of, you know, naturally gifted writers, he said, I don't believe this exists. By the way, this is somebody who studied writing under James Michener, who was a very famous American author. And so he teaches more of the mechanics of it. And so if you feel like you're not a gifted writer, but you need to use words to move people to action, my encouragement would be start practicing. Write something every day. Put together some exercises where you do things. And there are a variety of exercises you could do. I mean, here's a simple one that's actually a lot of fun. Go to AI and ask AI, write the most outlandish sentence about peanuts. And take that outlandish sentence about peanuts and use that as the opening sentence to whatever paragraph you're about to write that's going to sell your product or service. And what it does is it starts forcing a creativity. You have to build the bridge between peanuts and marketing services, or peanuts and, you know, gym memberships, or, you know, whatever your product or service is. And anybody can become a great writer. It just takes work. And if you want to stand above the noise, those are now the table stakes.
I'm fascinated by that phrase you use, the noise floor, rising above the noise floor. I love that. I think for lots of people who like working with sort of metaphors and analogies and things, that kind of makes so much sense, because that noise floor is, well, it's more than noise, in it's absolute chaos. It's carnage down there, really. And if we're going to be doing this as marketers and probably new age or emerging age salespeople, where we are now talking about the relationship and really truly listening and not selling widgets or, you know, features and benefits, doing this thing with authenticity, it comes back to this word wholesome again, doesn't it? This is the authentic way to communicate as more than just purely word monkeys, but actually maybe as true human beings. This is a differentiator, isn't it? Let the masses carry on to this kind of place in AI where you are going to sound identical to your competitor. And in fact, the SEO will prove that you are identical to your competitor, but you make the conscious choice to differentiate by just being you. There's something so simple in this, isn't there, really? It's not clever. It's not being, you know, super smart or anything like that. It's just about being you and doing this authentically. Feels good, doesn't it?
It does. And it's what people are looking for, because eventually the AI generated content is, it's going to sound the same. It's going to look the same. It's basically in some form or fashion repeating what's already been said, which John Mueller of Google has said, hey, the reason your AI written articles aren't ranking is because you're just using AI to quote what somebody else has already said. We're ranking the person who said it originally. And, but at the same time, it's an incredible tool. So let's say that you've run into a creative block and you're trying to figure out how to word things. And so AI is a great time to go in to ChatGPT and say, give me 10 sentences that express a squirrel jumped in the air and did a somersault. And it will come up with 10 variations of that or whatever concept you're trying to communicate. Well, all of a sudden you start seeing things worded in ways that you hadn't previously considered. And so it's a great assistant to help drive that creativity. And then you go back and you pick up from there and you take what it's given you and you see one idea that particularly resonates and you run with it. And so AI is a phenomenal assistant that will increase your productivity. And if, you know, at the same time, while I'm saying you have to rise above the noise, you have to rise above the noise quickly. And the one thing that guaranteed your competitors are doing, they're using AI to operate more efficiently. And so should you.
There's something neat again in here that kind of comes through in this whole kind of thread of the story that you're telling us here, Craig, which is it comes back to the trust within the relationship, doesn't it? Because here, you know, your customers rather, and certainly your prospects are looking for an opportunity probably to trust again, because a lot of us have become very distracted by, you know, the excitement of these emerging technologies and all the potential and everything. And we've almost kind of lost sight. I think many of us have kind of lost sight of actually the best bits of the pre-AI, pre-VR, pre-AR kind of world. And we're just getting carried away by the tech, whereas actually what we want to do is trust again, isn't it? Trust that relationship I had with that provider or that supplier or that business partner, it is actually still intact. And it's based on those human sensibilities of, you know, authenticity, of listening, of, you know, all the things that we've already talked about. It feels that trust is the really key kind of commodity that we should be trading on here, rather than just the hype of another, albeit very, very powerful emerging tech. Do you see trust as being the future for all of this?
Absolutely. Well, and that's that element of human behavior that doesn't care about tech. It doesn't care about time. Trust was important 1,000 years ago, you know, before there was an automobile, before there was a computer, you know, before there was electricity. Trust is important today. Trust will be important 1,000 years from now, presuming we still occupy this earth. The trust is the ongoing thing. And so I believe a lot of your listeners are marketers. And, you know, as a marketer, here's something I keep in mind. When a prospect gets on a call with me, one of the things I know, so I know two things. One, nobody gets on a sales call with a marketer unless they have a revenue problem. So just keep that in the back of your head. Okay, they have a revenue problem. They may not be talking about it, but I realize they're not getting on the phone with me unless they have a revenue problem. But the other thing that is important to realize is everybody that gets on the phone with you has a story, a bad story of marketing gone wrong. They hired some consultant and it didn't work out. And so that's really the subject of my book, Make Sales Magical, is how do you overcome that? You know, so when somebody comes to you, of course, you think you're different than the rest. You believe you're different from the rest, and you are. You know, there's validity in that statement. But from their perspective, you look just like another marketer that is poised to disappoint them in similar ways that they've been disappointed before. And so what are you trying to do? Most marketers in that moment are trying to get them to sign up for a retainer, you know, make a big commitment. And the emotion that they're feeling is, I don't know you. I don't trust you. I don't want to do that. And so there's this belief, and I would say it's a false belief that, okay, well, it just takes time. We have this long sales cycle where we have to build the trust until the point where they feel comfortable and they go ahead and hire me. And I would say that that's a false belief, because what I tackle and Make Sales Magical is, instead of taking that time of having countless meetings and you know, writing proposals or any of that, why don't you put together a really small project that actually solves a problem for them and price it stupidly cheap so they really lose nothing, even if it goes south or goes poorly. And when you do this, there's a number of magical things that happen in the process. When you come shoulder to shoulder with somebody and you solve a problem in their life, it causes the release of oxytocin in the body. Oxytocin is the bonding hormone that bonds baby to mother. And so when you do that, all of a sudden, those fears, remember, they have a bad marketing experience in their history. And when you solve a little problem in their life, it makes that disappear, makes you look different than the other marketers. You don't look different when they're initially approaching you. You do look different once you solve a problem in their life. And so that's why we advocate for something called a irresistible first-time offer. And, you know, people are probably familiar with the concept. You know, they've seen it in a variety of ways. You know, Sports Illustrated magazine used to have this special where if you subscribe to Sports Illustrated, you get a football phone. It was this tacky, you know, phone, but sold a lot of magazine subscriptions. And the problem is football phones won't pave the path to high ticket consulting deals. I've tried, not with specifically with football phones, but you know, sort of the marketing equivalent of it. Let me give an example of something else that won't work. You know, and I run into this every week. Some marketer says, "Hey, we do an audit." I'm like, you know, the problem with an audit, other than everybody else is doing them, is an audit doesn't solve a problem. It simply reveals the problems that are there. If you're wanting to bring real magic into your sales process, solve a problem. An audit doesn't solve a problem. Now, maybe an audit's necessary as a step before you solve that problem as a part of that mini project, but make sure you solve a problem. And when you do that, that just builds insane levels of trust in a very short period of time.
There are moments on my podcast when I just think that moment there is one of those kind of, it's going to make the Hall of Fame. And Craig, I think you've just hit one absolutely out of the park with this one, because that was so simple, but we're all not doing it and we all could do it. This is the thing. This is a choice, isn't it? You have the choice to be able to commit some resources, some time, some energy. And even if it's not the biggest big ticket customer here, it could be a kind of like a mid-range one. The value to a long-term valuable relationship there by doing that it's so worth it. I mean, that is a really, really genius piece of advice, I have to say. And I think I'm going to say on behalf of everybody, thank you for that. I can see everybody rushing for the notebooks and rushing for the keyboards thinking, oh, we've got an idea. We need to do this with company X or with customer Y, because that is the simple answer, isn't it? You have to give before you're going to get. So rather than pushing, you're giving them a reason to enter that relationship. It's genius.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and it's based on what we all study on marketing. You know, it's, you know, there's elements of reciprocity. There's some cognitive biases triggered in that. But, you know, in its most simple form, if you want somebody to trust you, solve a problem in their life. And, you know, there's a verse in the Bible that says those who are trustworthy in small things will be entrusted with big things. Now, you don't have to be a Christian or a Bible scholar to see the wisdom in that.
It is just so clear, isn't it? I mean, this is the thing. We all know it. So why don't we do it? Well, hopefully everybody from listening to you, Craig, today will be starting to do that, because it just makes such logical and such commercial and such financial sense to build those relationships from giving a little to get a lot in the longer term. And it shows a commitment, doesn't it, on behalf of the salesperson or the marketer and the brand, you know, the business more broadly. If this is a big ticket, multi kind of level purchase decision, it shows that the brand selling or the brand providing is committed to a relationship. It's not just, hey, we're after a quick buck. You know, we actually want to commit to you guys before you actually give us anything back. That's so there. That's quite profound, isn't it, really, for business trust, loyalty, retention going forward.
Yeah. And, you know, you were touching on something earlier, and it reminded me of a product. And this comes back to the whole thing of, at the end of the day, we're here to solve problems in people's lives. And if you're not solving problems and you're not delivering value, you have a lot to worry about. And the fear that I have with AI is a lot of people think what people are looking for is AI. No, you know, their customers aren't looking for AI. They're looking for the things that they hope AI will enable, the transformation that AI will enable. And so AI isn't the solution to a problem. It's a solution to many problems once you define the problem and make sure it's a problem that it can sufficiently tackle. But there's a product that I'm sure you're aware of that I keep looking at, and I just cannot, for the life of me, figure out the problem it's solving. So Apple launched their Vision Pro glasses. These are extremely expensive VR headsets. I think, you know, in the United States, they start at $3,500. And, you know, you can do spatial computing and what have you. And I keep looking at them, and for the life of me, I can't figure out the problem they solve. I see them, sorry about that. I see them delivering some entertainment value, but that's a high price tag for entertainment. You know, I can go to an IMAX theater for an immersive movie experience for significantly less. And there's more content on IMAX than there is, you know, on the Vision Pro. Maybe the Vision Pro will get there. But I've really been struggling trying to figure out what problem that solves. And I may be proven wrong. Maybe there's something I'm missing. But when I look at historical Apple products, you know, the iPod was, well, the original iMac when Steve Jobs came back to Apple, easy and quick internet. That was the whole, you know, value proposition of the original iMac. We'll get you on the internet within 1 minute. You know, at a time when everybody was trying to figure out the internet. Then the iPod comes along. We'll put 1,000 songs in your pocket. Then the iPhone comes along. You no longer need to carry an iPod, you know, mobile phone and internet browser. You get 3-in-1. And then the iPad comes along. And you can, it's basically a book where you can do lightweight computing with a full day of battery life. You know, you don't need a big bulky laptop sitting in your lap to do, you know, to read the news or whatever. And so I understood the problems those were solving. I can't figure out the problem that the Vision Pro is solving. And I would say, you know, for anybody, if you're struggling with sales, maybe it's because you're not clear on the problem you're solving.
Craig, this has been such a great kind of insight into both, I guess, you know, in lots of ways, some of the elements within the book that I'm going to encourage everybody to get a copy of, because, well, in fact, both of the books, really, because they're both fundamentally linked, but they're both very different stories. And we're going to put some links in the show notes below. So if you're very interested in grabbing yourself a copy of Craig's book, I will encourage you to do so, because this is really, really profound, but simple, but so, so powerful stuff. And I would certainly agree with you. I'm on your side of the fence here, Craig, with the whole kind of thing about let's use AI responsibly, but appropriately. And I think retaining the human in the customer relationship is, going forward, it has to be the way that businesses will succeed. But I do love that Apple Vision Pro example, because I couldn't come back with an answer there. I couldn't justify it. It's like, yeah, it'd be nice to have one, but so, yeah, the jury's out on that one, Craig, but we will see. Time will certainly tell. Thank you so much for your time today, Craig. Really, really appreciate taking the time out of your busy day.
Neil, it's been a delight. And you know what? I actually have some gifts for your audience. So if you go to my website, alliesforme.com, that's spelled A-L-L-I-E-S, the number 4-M-E.com, and add / Neil Wilkins, all lowercase, all one word. It will take you to a page where you just fill out a form and you'll get a guide on how to build first-time offers. And so you can learn from that guide, basically learn from my mistakes, and I made many mistakes. And the other thing that comes with that is we get 23-day access to a course on building first-time offers. And just for clarity, we're the reason we do 23 days is we study human behavior. And I know that if I give unlimited access to this course, you'll sign up, never take it, forget about it, and will not change your life. My goal is that it changes your life. So we have 23 days access. It drives sense of urgency. We see it in the analytics. People go in and consume the content. That is our goal. So both of those are available to anybody that's listening if they go to alliesforme.com/Neil Wilkins.
Brilliant, Craig. Thank you so much. And everybody, that was a surprise. I was not expecting Craig to give you that as a reward for sharing our journey today. So thank you, Craig. That's brilliant. And I'm also going to put the link to your podcast as well, Leaders and Legacies, into the notes as well, because again, I have no doubt at all people are going to be wanting to stay close to you as you start to develop even more, you know, essential reading and great resources. So thank you.
Thank you, Neil.